Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has more titles than letters to his name, but to summarize, he is passionate about finding ways to save the planet and improve the environment. Besides his work as senior attorney for the National Resources Defense Council, the Hudson River Keeper, and the Pace University School of Law, he's also a licensed master falconer. He delivers the keynote address at the Concert for the Climate this Saturday at Caw Point Riverfront Park. Later on this hour, one other speaker at Saturday's event joins us, Bill McKibben of 350.org. But first up, Robert Kennedy Jr., who serves as chief prosecuting attorney for the Hudson River Keeper and president of Waterkeeper Alliance. Time magazine has named him one of its heroes of the planet. He joins us this morning from New York City. And Bobby, welcome. So nice to have you here this morning.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Now, we've had all these natural disasters in recent years, you know, hurricanes and tornadoes. Given that global warming is seen as a factor in all of these, why isn't the country, in your view, doing more when it comes to the environment, Bobby? I mean, why isn't there a little sense of panic out there?
Well, there is panic. I just walked out of a meeting with members of the insurance industry, and there is panic in some sectors, including some of the big economic sectors. We actually spend more in this country, and this is one of the things they were talking about. We spent more in this country this year on climate-related disasters than we did on the federal education budget. The federal education budget is about $94 billion, and we spent over $100 billion on disasters, and that's before the Colorado rainstorms. So, your question is, why aren't we doing more? Because there are strong vested interests in the carbon sector among the incumbents who are making a lot of money on carbon, and they do not want to see us shift to wind and solar and renewables. If that shift is happening, you know, this year we built more wind and more solar than all of the incumbents combined, than oil, coal, natural gas, and nuke combined. So you're seeing we can now produce electrons in that sector cheaper than any of the incumbents can, but they have the political clout. And they to get the subsidies, they have huge hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies every year that tilt the playing field away from us, that deceive the public against global warming. They have over 80 think tanks now on Capitol Hill whose purpose is to deceive the public about global warming. They fill them with these phony scientists that we call biostitutes. And they print out, you know, they're tobacco scientists, and they did the same thing as the tobacco industry did. You think about this, the tobacco industry, by employing these same strategies, was able to avoid regulation for 60 years, even though for that entire period it was well known that this industry was killing one out of every four of its customers that used its product as directed. So, and they spent billions of dollars on deceiving the public. And, you know, 10 years ago, I remember during the Clinton administration when the seven heads of the seven big tobacco companies came before Congressman Waxman's committee on national television, raised their right hand and swore under oath that they did not believe that tobacco caused any ill health effects. So the oil industry is doing the same thing. Exxon spends hundreds of millions of dollars on deceiving the public about global warming, and then they funnel much more than that into the political system. So they have, you know, Congress essentially, they're indentured servants on Capitol Hill. And what does that do? That means that they change the laws to impede the adoption of wind and solar and to facilitate the adoption or the continued dominance of coal and oil. Let me just say this. Over the past 10 years, we have built 26,000 miles of pipeline in this country. service the oil and gas industry. And we've, at the same period, we've only built 600 miles of transmission lines, which are, is absolutely critical infrastructure for wind and solar.
And from your vantage point, Bobby, you overcome this kind of money, this kind of opposition. How do you go about beating them?
Well, you know, it really, it's about democracy. It's about making our democracy work and making our democracy and our free market economy to serve the public interest. And so that you force them to internalize their costs so that they have to pay the true cost of bringing oil to the marketplace and bringing it to the consumers. Right now, most of those costs are subsidized. Mm-hmm. You know, and we pay the industry imposed. For example, the coal industry has thousands of miles, tens of thousands of miles of coal roads that cost billions of dollars to the public every year. That some of them have 18 to 22 inches of asphalt on them, which cost billions of dollars to the public. But the coal industry doesn't pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
We do. So coal is able to claim that it's cheap and it only costs, you know, 11 cents a kilowatt hour. But in truth, they're not telling you that you're also paying the cost of those coal roads. In addition to that, the National Academy of Sciences found last year that every freshwater fish in America is now contaminated with mercury, which is coming from coal-burning power plants. Mm-hmm. Well, that is imposing huge costs on the public that they're not paying for. There's 60,000 Americans every year who die from inhaling ozone and particulates from coal-burning power plants, and the cost of that to the American health system is about $345 billion a year. Well, that's a subsidy to coal, and, you know, acid rain and mountaintop removal. These are all giant subsidies that are damaging our country, and we're pretending that this fuel is cheap, but in fact, it's much, much more expensive if you look at all of the costs to society as a whole, which is what the free market ought to be doing.
We're visiting with Bobby Kennedy, Jr. He serves as chief prosecuting attorney for the Hudson River Keeper. Time magazine has named him one of its heroes of the planet. He'll be speaking this weekend on Saturday at a conference in Kansas City, Kansas, the Concert for the Climate at Call Point Riverfront Park. The event runs from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Admission is free. More information, concertfortheclimate.org. You know, Bobby, one thing when I asked you about what needs to be done to defeat these special interests, at least from your standpoint, you didn't mention civil disobedience. And I know you and Bill McKibben, who's joining us later on this hour, zip-tied yourselves to the White House fence in February to protest the Keystone XL pipeline, and you even refused police orders to disperse. What went into your decision to be there that day, and what happened?
Well, first of all, I would say this. There's things that we ought to be doing before we do civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. We ought to be using our law court, and we ought to be using the democratic system. But the democratic system has been undermined by these huge campaign contributions, which have turned our, you know, which is just it's a form of a legalized bribery.
Yeah.
And now the Supreme Court, through the in the Citizens United case, has unleashed a new tsunami. Since 1907, it's been illegal for corporations to give directly to federal political candidates. That was a law that was passed by Teddy Roosevelt because he saw our democracy was being destroyed by the robber barons during the Gilded Age.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a key reform to restoring democracy in this country. And this Supreme Court, which is the most business-friendly Supreme Court that we've had since the 1880s, has gotten rid of that impediment and has allowed this tsunami of oil money and coal money to flow into the political process. And that really, you know, when I talk about restoring democracy, that's what I'm talking about, is the democracy should serve the public, not the interests of the oil companies and the coal companies. We went to those companies have used that political clout to make it almost impossible for landowners and others to sue somebody who wants to put a pipeline through their company, through their property. So the XL pipeline which is not going to benefit America. It's going to benefit the Koch brothers and a few big oil producers in Canada. The oil is not coming to our country. It's going to China. It's going to actually raise the price of oil in the United States, because oil prices in our country are not dictated by global supply. They're dictated by refinery capacity in the United States. And this XL, the tar sands oil, takes up tremendous refinery time and space. And that oil is going to refineries in Port Arthur, Texas, which at this moment would be refining oil for the United States. So it's actually going to raise the price of oil in the United States by about 10 cents a gallon. It's going to create, over the long term, according to the industry's own studies, 32 jobs. And it's going to poison our waters and do a lot of other bad things. But we can't sue them. We can't use the democratic mechanisms and tools that normally that you ought to be able to use in a democracy to stop a project that is going to undermine the public commons.
You can't sue them. Why, Bobby?
Well, you can't sue them because the Congress has gotten rid of, and this is on many levels, for example, Congress has exempted fracking from the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Water Act, and others, so that any other industry that did what they're doing, we'd be able to sue, but we can't sue the oil companies. And the same is true for pipelines. Congress has exempted pipelines and given them essentially the power of eminent domain, so they can run their pipe right through your yard and your kitchen and your farm field and your streams, even if you don't want it there.
You know,
so you don't have any property rights to say no and to say, you can't trespass on my property. So because of that, because of all of these waivers of the laws when it comes to the oil companies, we really didn't have any choice but civil disobedience, which is really the final choice in the democracy. And we were working, by the way, with the Capitol Police. It was interesting because the Capitol Police told us there was about 2,500 people who wanted to chain themselves to the White House fence.
Right.
But the Capitol Police said to us, we can't handle that kind of influx, and if they do that, we're just going to leave them there. We won't even pay attention to it. They said, if you limit the number of people to 50, then we will arrest you.
Okay.
So we had 2,500 supporters around us, cheering us, but 50 people were chosen to actually chain themselves to the fence in cooperation with the Capitol Police. And the Capitol Police were very professional and very nice, and they processed us quickly, and I actually got to out of there that evening and was able to make a speech in North Carolina or West Virginia.
You know, Bobby, apparently President Obama makes the decision, the call on the Keystone XL pipeline. I know Congress is trying to intervene in that decision. My question is, he's delayed a decision on that once again to next year. What do you think he's going to do? What's Barack Obama going to do when it comes to approving or disapproving the Keystone pipeline?
Well, I've talked directly to the president about this issue, and I asked him what were his criteria. And this is after he gave his speech about it, in which he said he would not allow the Keystone Pipeline if there was any net increase in global carbon emissions. So what he said, and I asked him what did he mean by that, and what he said was, look, this pipeline is going to create billions of dollars in wealth for the oil companies and for the province of Alberta. And he said, if the money makers choose to use a significant portion of that wealth to reduce, to mitigate emissions, for example, by building wind farms or solar plants or transmission lines or doing something so that there will be no net increase in carbon. We know how much carbon is going to come out of the of Alberta. In fact, there's more carbon in the tar sands than there is if we actually burn it, than we have burned in all of human history combined, more than all the oil in Saudi Arabia, more than all of the oil that we've burned. So what he was saying is if they show that they're going to somehow use their profits to eliminate carbon emissions, then and so that there's no net increase, then I will consider allowing them to do it. But they have to show me that they're going to do that first. And I personally don't believe that they can make that kind of demonstration.
Again, Bobby Kennedy gives the keynote address on Saturday at the Concert for the Climate at Call Point Riverfront Park. That's over in KCK. The event runs from 11 in the morning to 6 in the evening. Admission is free. More information, concertfortheclimate.org. Bobby, it's been a pleasure to have you with us today. Thanks for taking some time.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
I look forward to seeing you.
You bet. And now for a guy who is the most content to live the life of a writer and professor in the Adirondacks of Vermont, Bill McKibben finds himself away from home a lot these days, giving speeches, organizing protests, and taking on giants, all in an effort to slow global warming. Bill McKibben's latest book is Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. He's founder of 350.org, and he also will be speaking at this weekend's Concert for the Climate, just before Bobby Kennedy, in fact. He joins us today from Seattle. And Bill McKibben, welcome to Up to Date. It's a pleasure to have you, too.
Hey, good to be with you.
The question I wanted to ask Bobby before he had a run, I couldn't get to it, Bill. What do you make of President Barack Obama's record on the environment so far? 5 years in, what do you make of it, Bill?
I'd say pretty weak. He's done, I mean, the comparison, I guess, if you want to compare him with George Bush, he's better president on the environment than George Bush. On the other hand, you know, I've drunk more beer than my 12-year-old niece, you know. It's the bar set pretty low. You can name a couple of things he's done that are useful. None of them are really commensurate with the scale of the problem, and none of them have been against the kind of resistance that he faces when he takes up the Keystone Pipeline. I think that'll be the test. I think if he stands up to the fossil fuel industry there, then he'll have not only a little bit of a climate legacy for himself, but more importantly, he'll be the first world leader to have said, here's a project we're not actually going to do because of its effect on the climate. That'll be the first time a world leader said that. It will open up, hopefully, help be a kind of wedge to reopen the climate negotiations that went completely aground in Copenhagen in 2009.
Well, Bill, as you know, he keeps putting off the decision. He delayed it until after the election last year. Now he's put it off until 2014. What's your sense of what's behind that thinking? Why does he keep delaying this big call in the face of terrific pressure from Republicans who want this pipeline to go through?
Well, because he's got terrific pressure from people who don't want it to go through. And it's become the iconic environmental fight of our time. It's been the occasion of the largest civil disobedience actions in 30 years in this country. In 2011, 1,253 of us went to jail to kind of launch this thing. He knows that young people in particular care deeply about climate change, and that this is the place where his record will be made or not.
You know, Bill, you had this in the book on the night in 2011 that the president announced delaying a final Keystone decision until at least 2013. You recount a senator saying to you, you need to understand that big oil never loses in this town, not ever. Did you ever have any inkling of just how much tougher things were going to get when it comes to this issue until that moment?
No, I mean, I was amazed we got that far. I mean, when we took this on, everybody considered the pipeline a done deal. National Journal, which is kind of the trade paper for Capitol Hill, did a poll of their 300 energy insiders in 2011, and 97% of them said that TransCanada would have its permit by the end of 2011. So it was a done deal, and it's so far we've managed to make it come undone for a while. Whether in the end the wealth of the fossil fuel industry will be enough to push it through remains to be seen. We've tried to find different currencies to work with, the currencies of movement, passion, spirit, creativity. Sometimes we've spent our bodies too.
And I gather then that the fact that the president has delayed the decision, at least on some scale, is a victory on your side of the ledger. Am I seeing that right, Bill?
Well, I mean, at first delay was all we could hope for, but now we want and need the president to deny the permit for this thing and say this is oil that has to stay in the ground.
You know, a couple of years ago, the House voted to revive Keystone by passing legislation to bypass the president on this issue and give the power to the Congress. You calculated that the 234 members who voted for this had taken, get this, a total of $42 million in campaign donations from the fossil fuel industry itself. As you write in the book, knowing someone's party, in fact, was far less important than knowing how much cash they'd gotten from whom. Again, an awfully tough lesson to learn there, Bill.
Yeah, you know, I'd never spent much time in Washington before any of this, and I tend to a kind of, I'm afraid, a sort of naive patriotism. I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts, where my summer job for when I was in high school was giving tours of the Battle Green to tourists as they arrived and kind of telling the story of the beginning of the fight for American independence. So it was kind of depressing to get to Washington. And, you know, I'd always sort of heard that it was, you know, lobbyists owned the place and things, but I kind of thought people might be speaking sort of metaphorically.
It turns out they weren't wrong.
Describing reality, yes.
Yeah.
And it is depressing. Now, you know, look, I try not to be cynical any more than I need to be, and I have the good luck of, I'm in Seattle today helping do some organizing, but I live in Vermont, so I have the great pleasure of having, for my senator, Bernie Sanders. And
yeah.
So for me, it's a reminder all the time that there are uncynical people in this stuff for the right reasons.
You know, Bill, by all means, I don't want to diminish the work that you've done for so many years on all this, but as a guy who covers politics for a living, as I sit back and watch all this the last 20 years, you know, recently we're going through tornadoes and hurricanes and drought and all this stuff, and yet, and scientists, you know, attributing all this to global warming, and yet I haven't seen the public sort of beginning to sort of charge forward with a vigor that resembles anything we saw back in the 60s for Vietnam, or really anything else when it comes to beginning to demand change, when it comes to, you know, legislation that would help climate change, that kind of thing. Are you surprised by that?
Well, you know, I'm surprised, really, that that's, I got to say, that that's what it's going to take. You know, I wrote the first book about all this back in 1989.
Yeah, right.
Nature. And back then, you know, I figured that if scientists were going up to Capitol Hill every year and explaining that the worst thing in the world is happening, and economists left, right, and center were coming right after them and saying, well, look, the beginning of the solution anyway is fairly simple. Stop letting the fossil fuel industry be the only industry that gets to throw out their waste for free, you know. Put a price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the environment. I expected that, you know, just that our system was set up so that reason would prevail. But we've had a basically 25-year bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing. And so at a certain point, you know, we do have to try to build these movements. They're getting bigger, you know. But yes, you're right. At the moment, physics is still winning.
No,
the Arctic melted last summer. We're losing, but I do think that the number of people concerned is rising steadily. The polling data is pretty clear, and I think that's. I'd like to take credit for it. You know, say that we're all succeeding in educating everybody. I think the biggest educator's been Mother Nature. 80% of U.S. counties have had a federally declared disaster in the last 2 years. At a certain point, you know, looking out the door and seeing, you know, endless flood or endless drought begins to kind of shake you up.
Yeah. You know, again, if President Obama was joining us for this conversation, he would say some things have happened. You know, their mileage standards have risen on automobiles.
That's the best example so far. I think it's probably illustrative, however, of the kind of, you know, what they have done. They've done the easiest things they can do. They've managed to get mileage standards increased at the moment that Detroit was in bankruptcy and the auto companies were in federal receivership, essentially, and there was no way for them to oppose it. They've been much less forthright when there's been big opposition from big oil.
Bill McKibben is our guest. He's been one of the great activists when it comes to improving the environment on our planet. His latest book, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. He's founder of 350.org. And again, he speaks this weekend as well with Bobby Kennedy Jr. At the Concert for the Climate at Call Point Riverfront Park. The event runs from 11 to 6. Admission is free. More information and a schedule of speakers, concertfortheclimate.org. If you want to join our conversation here, 816-235-2888, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. Or you can also tweet us at @kcuruptodate. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with Bill McKibben. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, visiting with Bill McKibben, one of the great environmental activists in this country. His latest book, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. He is founder of 350.org. I want to know, what's your theory about why the public hasn't begun demanding more when it comes to improvements in the environment, a stop to global warming? What else needs to happen to sort of wake up people as to what is going on out there? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email, UpToDate @kcur.org. You can also tweet us @kcuruptodate. You know, Bill, you're no stranger to the environmental movement. Your 1989 book, you mentioned it before, End of Nature, is considered the first book on climate change written for a general audience. You know, over the years, you produced a dozen books on the environment, and your concern over global warming has continued to only grow. When did writing about it stop just being enough, Bill?
Well, at some point in the last 6 or 7 years, it just became clear that we weren't, you know, that yet another book on this was not going to turn the tide.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't really know anything about organizing, but I got together with some young people, and we started 350.org, and with kind of beginner's luck, it became the first big global grassroots climate campaign. We've organized about 15,000 rallies in every country on Earth except North Korea at this point. And it's been exciting to watch that education, and exciting to watch sort of take that movement and put it more into the business of confrontation. The Keystone fight, with now this huge push for divestment from fossil fuel stock, that's you know, already in 6 or 8 months convinced a number of universities, 10 or 15 big cities, Seattle, San Francisco, Portland, Providence. Several of our religious denominations already on board, selling their fossil fuel stock in a way to kind of, well, not to bankrupt Exxon, that's probably impossible, but to kind of morally bankrupt them,
mm-hmm.
politically bankrupt them.
You know, that's happening, but you also made a decision at some point to become an activist and actually engage in civil disobedience along with Bobby Kennedy. Did you experience any fears about doing that, Bill?
My main fear when we asked people to come for this first big gathering was that it was only college kids would show up, and I didn't think college kids should have to be the cannon fodder for this thing because, you know, if you're in college right now, if you're 22, maybe an arrest warrant is the best thing in the whole world for your resume. One of the few virtues of growing older, unmixed blessings, is that past a certain point, I guess, what the hell are they going to do to you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we were really pleased to watch people show up in D.C., you know, with about as much hair as I have. We didn't ask people, how old are you? We did say, who was president when you were born? And the two biggest cohorts of people came from the FDR and the Truman administration.
Wow.
That was exciting, and it was good to see elders starting to act like elders. Yeah, you know, I spent 3 days in Central Cell Block in D.C. Sounds like it would be. But it wasn't the end of the world. The end of the world is the end of the world, and that's why we do the stuff we do.
Okay. Well, what needs to happen to get the public more engaged in the environment? That's the question on the table here. 816-235-2888, or email us updatedate@kcur.org. Paul from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on this morning. Good morning.
You hate to be a pessimist, but, you know, we don't control the Canadian tar sands. The Canadians do. We can't educate 1.8 billion Chinese and a billion Hindus in India and heck knows whoever else is there in the rest of the world. I mean, we're, what, 300 and some odd million people in the U.S., and I've bought as high mileage of car as I can. I recycle everything I can. I try to watch my trips. But I got a feeling in the end that it's going to be a real long, rough road to hoe to get anything done climate change-wise, because we're really small.
Yeah. Now, there's something to that. The good news is that there are activists all over. So the Canadians, 2 years ago, the oil companies were saying, well, if we don't get Keystone, we'll build a pipeline to the Pacific coast in British Columbia and ship all our oil to China that way, and, you know, thumb their nose at us. Activists in Canada have completely stopped that. It's the Premier of British Columbia said a few weeks ago that it's not going to be built. You know, a place like Alberta, the oil's kind of pretty landlocked. You know, they need something like Keystone XL to get it out. And certainly to keep expanding that operation, they need the sort of money that this would bring in. So you're right. It's a very hard fight, and it is made harder by the fact that all over the world there are people who are just beginning to use substantial amounts of energy. The good news is that we know our way out of this if we want to take it at this point. Technologies that were kind of primitive 25 years ago, like sun and wind, are pretty mature now. The one country that's taken all this stuff seriously, is a big country, non-Scandinavian country, is Germany. There were days this summer when the Germans generated half the power they used from solar panels within their borders.
Hmm.
You know, and really, if you think about that, that's pretty remarkable. Not many people have ever taken their sun-splashed February vacation in, you know, Dusseldorf. You know, a country that had at its disposal, oh, I don't know, California, Nevada, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Florida, Missouri might be able to generate a lot of solar power, too. You never know.
Yeah.
But we'll find out only once we really get to work. At the moment, there are more solar panels in Bavaria than there are in the United States.
In Bavaria. No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Paul, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Yeah. Again, our number here, 816-235-2888. What do you think the president's going to do, Bill, when it comes to issuing a permit or not issuing it when it comes to the Keystone Pipeline? Where's your current betting line on this thing?
You know, I don't really, unlike Bobby Kennedy, I've never met the president. The only time I was ever inside the White House was a tour in sixth grade, I think. I mean, I've gotten arrested outside it twice now, so I know the fence pretty well. But I've got no inside information. I just think that our odds go up the more people make it clear their commitment. This past Saturday, there were 215 demonstrations in 47 states around the country asking the president to draw a line on Keystone. The one I was at here in Seattle, there was a half-mile-long line of people in red shirts along the bay saying, draw a line like this one, Mr. President.
Yeah.
I think that it's, you know, as I say, the iconic environmental fight of our time. And hence, I think there's at least some chance that the right thing will happen.
Jim from Kansas City, Missouri, joins us now. I think he was at one of those protests. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. I want to say hello to Bill, and I've been to Washington, D.C. three times for 350.org events, including an arrest in 2011. And I'm calling to say that we had 99 people at a draw-the-line event here in Kansas City on Saturday.
Fantastic.
And so I'm just calling to say keep rolling on and forward together.
Fantastic. That's very good news, and it's always moving just to see people stepping up. You know, one of the interesting things about this movement as it evolves is that it doesn't have any sort of huge leaders or central organizations. I mean, there are people like Bobby Kennedy that everybody knows,
right.
But there's really no Martin Luther King figure, you know, in this fight. And in a weird way, I think that the fossil fuel industry is so sprawling, protean, everywhere, that you need a resistance that's kind of sprawling and everywhere. Lots of people fighting things that are of local danger, and then coming together for big days of action like the one we just had, to make a point about the country and the globe. In a way, if you think about it, the movement looks like the energy system we want to build, not a few huge power plants, but millions of solar panels on millions of roofs kind of linked together.
Again, you have a couple chances to see and hear Bill McKibben coming up in the days ahead. He speaks on Saturday at the Concert for the Climate at Caw Point Riverfront Park in KCK. More information, concertfortheclimate.org. There's a link to that on our website, kcur.org. You can also see him at 7 Friday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza at an event sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway. Call 913-384-3126 for tickets for that event. Back to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Why aren't Americans more up in arms about the environment these days? That's the question on the table. Mac from Waldo. Mac, good morning.
Morning. I was wondering why the Canadians can't build their own refineries instead of building a big expensive pipeline to ship it all down to Texas.
How about that, Bill?
Well, because the economics of it don't work for them. They've got these refineries they want to use on the coasts, which is where they want to send this stuff out. I mean, this stuff's not even going to the States. It's going out to the rest of the world. And the payoff for, you know, any of us is tiny. There was a series of ads now running on stations around the country pointing out that, once the pipeline's built in a couple of years, it'll produce a grand total of 35 jobs. This is not the way out of our economic problems. One way out of them is the widespread adoption of the renewable energy that actually requires a lot of people to make it work. No one is going to put their house on a boat and send it to China to get solar panels installed. You know, that has to happen here.
Mac, thank you for the call. Bill, I should point out, you know, Republicans, congressional supporters of Keystone, pound away on two main points. They point to the loss of tens of thousands of jobs for Americans if this pipeline is built. They also talk about energy security, that this pipeline helps ensure that. What do you say about both those issues?
Well, I just sort of gave the numbers on the jobs.
Yeah.
There aren't many permanent ones at all. And as for energy security, I mean, the stuff's getting shipped overseas. That's why they're bringing it to the Gulf of Mexico. They want to put it on a boat and take it elsewhere. So that doesn't add to our energy security at all. Energy security will come when we produce energy in this country with methods that don't cause damage to this country. I mean, there's no security in, say, Colorado right now, where they're, you know, still trying, they'll be trying for months to clean up after the worst flooding they've ever had, the kind of flooding that you can get once the atmosphere, since warm air holds more water vapor than cold, once you've made the atmosphere 5% wetter and greatly increased the number of floods. There's no security with an energy system that pushes the Atlantic Ocean into the New York City subway system or that causes drought on the scale we saw across the Midwest in 2012. The federal government spent more money last year cleaning up after Sandy and after the Midwest drought than the federal government spent on education.
Let's go back to some calls here. Imani from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on with Bill McKibben. Imani, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. You asked the question why people are not, this is not a front burner issue with them. And I think for most people, their big issue is the economy. You know, the people that don't have jobs, the people who want to have a better income, and the people who maybe have the money to be concerned about this are paying $600 for an iPhone, and they want to be able to have the energy to plug it in. you know, we need to have alternatives to replace the oil that you're fighting against. And if those things are not in place, I don't think people are going to be too excited about making that kind of a move.
Bill?
Yeah, I mean, look, if it were easy, we'd probably have done it by now. And not easy, but the only, as I've been trying to say, the only thing harder than dealing with it is going to be not dealing with it. If one thinks it's expensive to make this transition off fossil fuel, yeah, it'll cost some money. But the only good estimate we have is from the British economist Sir Nicholas Stern, done for the UK government, shows that if we don't deal with it, the cost of climate change is equal to the cost of World War I, World War II, and the Great Depression combined. That's a lot of money.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Brian emailed this at uptodate@kcur.org, Bill. I've read all of your books, and I thought Deep Economy was the most poignant with respect to the underlying causes of many current environmental challenges. Do you plan to dive back into that stream of content anytime soon?
Well, I mean, I'll keep working on all this stuff. At a certain point, there's no use sort of just restating the obvious over and over again. I think now the challenge is to get people who understand that there's a problem to really go to work on it.
Now, Oil and Honey, your latest book, tells two stories. One is your activist story, and the other, which went on simultaneously, was your growing involvement with a local beekeeper in your home state of Vermont. Bill, tell us about Kirk Webster and the project that you launched with him.
Sure. You know, I wanted a way to talk about the local as well as the global dimension of all of this. We've got to get things right close to home. We've got to build local food systems, a new way of living in our country. And we're starting to do that in places like Vermont, where I live. And the vehicle I used to describe it was my neighbor, a wonderful beekeeper named Kirk Webster, who's really the first big chemical-free apiarist in the country. His hives are surviving the onslaught that's decimating so many other beekeepers around the country. As you know, something like half the beehives in the country may have died last year.
Right.
So it's a timely story there, too, you know. It was really fun to hang out with Kirk and to see how beautiful this apiary is, and I'm afraid to be reminded how fragile it is in the face of climate change as well. I mean, look, Vermont had its Colorado moment 2 years ago when Hurricane Irene dropped absolutely record amounts of rain on Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
The state almost washed away, and many of our best small organic farms did wash away. So you got to work both on a local and a global level. But the stuff about the bees was wonderful. They're remarkable animals. Once you get past the sting, they're really just so charming to think about. They're almost the only, well, maybe the only example I can think of an animal that's both wild and domesticated at the same time.
Hmm.
And they're kind of like sensors for they're out there roaming the whole countryside before they come back at night to the hive. And hence they're offering a kind of ongoing report on the health of the world around us.
In the chapter in your book, it's titled Simply Simple, you draw an analogy between the colony of honeybees, between a colony of honeybees and corporations and the way they work, Bill. What is that analogy?
Well, what I said was, someone asked me a question about Citizens United and should corporations be treated as people. And I said, if you think about it, corporations are really more, in a sense, like bees. They're very good at doing one thing and doing it very well. I mean, bees can take tiny pollen by the millions and create honey out of them. Corporations can take widespread raw materials and somehow out comes a car and at an affordable price. That's pretty remarkable. What they're not good at is the thing that actual humans are good at, which is self-reflection. We're more complicated than that. There are things like religion or art that cause us sometimes to act in counter-instinctual ways, ways that never happen in a beehive or in a corporation.
no corporation decides to forego profit it could have because it has, you know, decides about some message from the universe, you know, the way that humans do all the time. I think the common denominator is that they're simple, not that they're evil, that they're simple.
Mm-hmm.
And given the power of speech, they will just use it to keep doing what they're doing. Another way of saying it is, if you want to tap the tar sands, then you need a corporation to do it. If you want to make honey, then you need a hive of bees. But if you want to figure out whether making honey is a good idea, bees are the last people on Earth to ask. I mean, you already know what their answer is going to be.
Yeah, right. You know, over the years, you've put pressure on presidents, you've worked the political process, you've assembled at UN meetings, and you've still found yourself asking from time to time, what if we'd aimed wrong? You know, what if the basic logic where our predicament meant we should be shifting focus a different way? What answer did you finally wind up giving yourself to that, Bill?
To the question of?
Just this notion of, what did you think if you ever thought you were aiming at the wrong thing?
Well, I think in the end, the thing we have to aim at is the fossil fuel industry. That's where the money and power is. You know, we spent a long time chastising each other for, you know, not having the right light bulbs or things, and it's a very good idea to put the right light bulb in. But, you know, that's not going to make the math work in the time that we've got. We've got to take on the political power that's kept us from ever getting anything done.
How much time do we have, and how dire is the predicament today, in your view, Bill?
I'd say it's pretty dire. I mean, 80% of the summer sea ice in the Arctic was gone by the end of last summer.
Wow.
We've taken one of the largest physical systems on Earth and broken it. The ocean is about 30% more acidic than it was 40 years ago. The atmosphere is 5% wetter, which is loading the dice for drought and for flood. You know, I mean, it's hard to imagine exactly what kind of warning we're waiting for. When Hurricane Sandy filled the streets of our greatest city, and the subways of our greatest city, with salt water, you would think that that would be cinematic enough to kind of get our attention.
You know, the other way you're pushing these days is to encourage universities to adopt a strategy of divestment. What are you trying to do?
We're trying to not bankrupt Exxon, as I say, but politically bankrupt them. So that's why a lot of churches and cities and colleges are selling their fossil fuel stock. It's a way to sever ties, to say this is a rogue industry now. It's using, planning to burn more carbon than scientists say we possibly can. And the sort of historical analogy is to the fight against apartheid in South Africa, where this was a very important tactic. When Nelson Mandela got out of prison, one of the first places he came was the University of California to thank students there for forcing the divestment of $3 billion worth of stock. He said, we fought for our own liberation, but we needed your help. That's why it's good news, you know, this summer that the United Church of Christ, the oldest Protestant denomination in the country, the one that kind of traces its roots back to the Pilgrims, announced that they were selling their fossil fuel investments. You know, they said it doesn't make sense to pay the pastor by investing in companies that are running Genesis backwards.
Yeah. We just have a minute left here, Bill. You've also come up with a strategy now based on three numbers, 2, 565, and 2,795. Can you briefly explain what those numbers represent?
Yeah, that's the math that really indicates exactly how the rogue industry, the fossil fuel industry, is. If we're going to hold temperature increases globally below 2 degrees Celsius, which is the red line the world has drawn, and a high red line, 1 degree melted the Arctic, so 2 degrees, we really are foolish to find out what it is, if it'll happen, but we will. If we're going to hold it below or at 2 degrees, we can only burn about 500 gigatons, 500 billion tons more carbon. But the fossil fuel industry, in its reserves of coal and gas and oil, now has about 2,800 gigatons worth of carbon that they've already identified and are planning to burn. Five times as much as the most conservative governments on Earth say would be safe. if they carry out their business plan, the planet tanks. That's why we need to stand up to them.
Again, Bill McKibben is the author of Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. He speaks on Saturday at the Concert for the Climate at Caw Point Riverfront Park in KCK. More information, concertfortheclimate.org. And again, you can see and hear him 7 Friday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. The event is sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway, 913-384-3126 for tickets. Bill, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Take care.
All the best, Bill. We'll see you out here. You bet. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, we'll take a look at the fiscal policies on many minds in Washington as lawmakers deal with an impending federal government shutdown. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. For KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.